all that matters is...
Wrong!
This town deserves a better class.
Heavy Metal Podcast.
I'm gonna get a...
If you do not listen, then the hell with you.
Walk through the gate of consciousness.
Hi there, every brony. Quinn here. Hey, I had a little message that I wrote and recorded for this episode of And Volume for All that ended up not making it onto the last episode, or the last part of the part of this part, carry the one of an episode. So I'd like to include it now. I decided to come back and re-record because this was important to me. I want to take a minute to say a very special thank you to a couple people who every day and in every way make the dystopian netherscape that is Twitter.com a better place to visit while you poop. Now, we all know my compatriots at the Deep Dive Podcast Network, Rye at Sabbath Bloody Podcast, Clay at Skinnered Reconsidered, T-Bone and his Prime Cuts, John and Nate at the Deep Purple Podcast, the Gregulator and Yoni Hot Dog at So Far So Pod, George and Hattie at Judas Priest Cast, and Paul Moody and Pals at In the Lap of the Pods. But also Diary of the Madman, Maiden A to Z, Universally Speaking Red Hot Chili Peppers Podcast, and the podcast Will Rock on Van Halen Backtracks, Aerosmith Revisited, the Tom Petty Podcast, Seaside Pod Review Regarding Lulu and Hawk Binge. But I'm not just going to sit here and name check all of them, because what kind of show is that? Look, we all know your metal Twitter superstars, your doomed boys and McDoom butts. Your well-disguised queer breakfast anarchist riff-wisers over on Punt Road, your grumpy G's and Ralph MCs, your feckin' metal, metal gods, chat pods, referendums, and requiems. But these are the Michael Jordans of metal Twitter. And you know what? Michael Jordan never won a championship by himself, and we know because he tried for 3 seasons with the Wizards. I'm talking about the Scottie Pippins of metal Twitter, the Dennis Rodmans, the Tony Kukoc's. I believe I pronounced that correctly. Every one of them, Hall of Famers, All-Stars, and game-changing superstars in their own right, who just happened to have joined the Justice League of metaphorical professional sports teams, the Chicago Bulls of the 1990s. These beautiful mother-punching bastards of reality may not have a podcast, but they don't need one. They show up every day with something to say, some feedback or some new perspective on the music that justifies the entire existence of self-centered jerks like me who think that other people want to hear us talk for an hour once every couple of weeks. So thank you to all the listeners who support this show, but a very special thank you to those of you who log on to Twitter and take the time to talk with me about music. So let me say now, hail Sagan to the Wolf of Oaks who turns your body to a corpse like Doc Sabbath and Chris Dent. And I want to give big ups to Big Fkin' Nads who pens with Gav, Chintan Nanavati, and Chasmataz in James Dean Martin's Origins of Ruin, because I have spent saisons in the abyss with Jersey and bonded with Dave B, Clay Schnell KC, Van Cleef, Lee, and Schmick of the 23, and after 7,000 zooms and charts of doom with Ali and Chains over some black coffee and metal and a cup of Roop Grape, me and Ian Winnick and Jack Allen still hang tight with Hang Tight and Chris White and Steve Hammond whenever we need some light healing, so Hazel the Bulldog and Daryl the Dirtbag don't let Rob mar Evil Ralphie's right to really let Rich's fuzz doom rip. Not that he ever would. Me and Fabe are just JK, with JJ Dixon all and Andrew Witten all getting real with Scotty Castile and heavy with Het Metal. Peru. Papa Snare don't care if Mr. McDonald, a.k.a. Bruno, and Byron the Flaming El Perro squash the future of a Mo Metal track by Nuwabum underscore Matt. Like Nige, all we want is to savage the tyrannous that's here in us. Like the Rocka fucking Rollas that we all are. Kyle Anderson. Yeah, I couldn't find a place for that one, Kyle. Sorry. I feel like I let you down, but if you listen to this show, you ought to be used to it. But seriously, genuinely, thank you all so much for listening to this podcast and letting me and the world know that sometimes you like it. It means the world to me that I get to tell these stories because they're the stories of my heroes. Be they just and righteous like Rob Halliford, or just self-righteous like today's subject, Dave Mustaine. Speaking of Dave Mustaine, on with the show. In no uncertain terms, Countdown to Extinction, a heavily political record that sees Dave Mustaine howling about animal rights and growling about issues as broad as taxation and the fragile state of the American man-pussy, blew the fuck up. It went to number 2 on the Billboard 200 and would eventually go double platinum. It was, and remains, Megadeth's most commercially successful album. But the closing moments of that record posed an important question both for the world of man and the world of metal. Where do we go from here? And the question could just as easily have applied to Dave Mustaine and Megadeth. By the time they released the follow-up to Countdown in 1994, the aforementioned grunge movement was fully in bloom. Nirvana having released both Nevermind and In Utero, Alice in Chains having released their sophomore album, the quintuple platinum classic Dirt, as well as the Stone Temple Pilots with Core and Purple, Pearl Jam's 10 and Verses, and Soundgarden's Bad Motor Finger and Super Unknown. The tectonic shift in the musical landscape left the big four of thrash in something of an existential limbo. Like the Bellamy Brothers character of the old hippie who don't know what to do, Metallica, Megadeth, Slayer, and Anthrax would soon find themselves asking, should they hang on to the old, or should they grab on to the new? Special thanks to my mom and dad who forced me to listen to 80s country radio as a child, making that last sentence possible. Anthrax would be the first to respond, and they would respond decisively in 1993 with what was arguably their best record. The Sound of White Noise, which saw the band replacing lead singer Joey Belladonna with former Armored Saint frontman and high-profile manscaping critic John Bush. Yes, that is the second iteration of that joke on this podcast, and no, you can't hope to avoid a third. White Noise was a definitive sonic shift for Anthrax away from the tongue-in-cheek nature of their earlier thrash records and toward a darker, more sincere tone and one that was heavily influenced by grunge under the production of Dave Jurgen, who had previously produced the debut albums for Alice in Chains and Jane's Addiction. Metallica put off any decision until 1996 when there's no good way to say this, released their Load, which my favorite retrospective review by Vice called derivative hard rock wrapped in plasma, piss, and jizz, that seemed to treat its listeners with something near contempt, daring them to turn this bullshit off. Please direct any complaints about the opinions presented on this episode to my press agent at ELONMUSK. And of course, Slayer responded to the unavoidable turning of the tide by not changing a fucking thing, except their drummer, on the 6th album and my inexplicable favorite, Divine Intervention. It wasn't until 1998 that Slayer would decide to play cultural catch-up after skipping a musical generation and dipped a severed toe into the waters of nu metal with Diabolus in Musica, an album which no one liked, no one less so than Slayer's guitarist and Human Software Microsoft Riff 98, Kerry King, who once called the album Our Turbo. I gotta stop letting Doomy edit my pod scripts. Which brings us to Megadeth, who in 1994 released their 6th record, Euthanasia. If there is an equivalent to the Black Album in Megadeth's discography, I think Euthanasia is it. But I don't say that to disparage the record. I don't loathe Euthanasia the way I loathe Metallica. Because Megadeth's commercial pinnacle came an album earlier and didn't come at the expense of everything that made them Megadeth. That said, the album certainly offers a clearer comparison to Metallica's fifth record than Countdown to Extinction, as the bulk of its runtime favors melody over metal and introspection over politics. The album opener that I played into the break, Reckoning Day, was inspired by Val Kilmer's line from the movie Tombstone, "Make no mistake, it's not revenge he's after, it's a reckoning." But thankfully, Dave decided to let go of a second Val Kilmer-themed track called "You Can Be My Wingman Anytime." Dodge that bullet. But after that, Train of Consequences and Addicted to Chaos are both reflective and self-critical songs, followed by the second single off the album, Mustaine's somewhat uncomfortable if imaginary goodbye to the world, Et tout le monde.
Moving on is a simple thing. What it leaves behind is hard. Your love is sleeping, no more pain. And the living are gone. Et tout le monde. Mes amis, je vous sais, je dois partir. These are the last words I'll ever speak, and you set me free.
MTV refused to show the video for Et tout le monde on their network, claiming it was pro-suicide, but have backed away from that stance more recently, airing reality television programs like Jersey Shore Family Vacation and X on the Beach, which seemed deliberately intended to make me want to kill myself. Continuing the theme of the personal over the political is The Killing Road, which is not about literal killing, but is about being on the literal and metaphorical road. And I Thought I Knew It All, another regretful track, which also happens to be about regret. There are notable exceptions to the autobiographical predominance on this album, including the title track, a bleak vision of the future for its would-be inheritors, and Family Tree, a heavy metal biography of the late John Phillips. Elysian Fields makes reference to war, but it reads more like a mythological romance on the topic than any kind of deconstruction. On the seventh track, Blood of Heroes, Mustaine again adopts the perspective of soldiers at war, but also one of the many rhetorical justifications used to convince them to sacrifice their lives, namely, die for our cause, and you can live forever in our hearts, or books, or whatever. As long as you're not alive anymore, that's the important part. But more than likely, the song is a first-person plural statement of triumph for the band itself, who at this point have made their mark on heavy metal history, found mainstream success, and are currently in the process of navigating the transition into a new musical universe, reminding the world that they are still here, and nearly a decade later, despite all of the odds, still alive.
Better left for dead. And now we are on a mission.
Euthanasia, as I said before, is a much more biographical and reflective record than anything in the Megadeth canon up to this point. My comparison to the Black Album isn't just due to the conspicuous lack of political material or the continued transition toward a more radio-centric sound, but also because Euthanasia functions as a kind of resolution for the early Megadeth records in the same way that Metallica's first five albums feel concluded by the record that shall remain nameless, because no one bothered to name it. Euthanasia feels like the final phase of Megadeth's transformation from scrappy, upstart outsiders to heavy metal luminaries, alongside Sabbath, Priest, Maiden, and whether they like it or not, Metallica. Nowhere is there stronger evidence for that fact than the album closer, Victory, which is actually better to read than to hear. It's not a great song, but Victory serves as a reminder of all Megadeth has accomplished in just shy of a decade, as Mustaine name-checks his own discography in a not-so-dissimilar way to how I name-checked my Twitter peeps at the top of this episode. Like so. Now, one day I started telling everyone that killing is my business and I was hung like a martyr. Cute. For looking down the cross, my skull beneath the skin prophesied last rites, love to death, my friends. Then I started seeing bad omens in my head. Good morning, Black Friday, will I wake up dead? If I ain't superstitious, then this won't mean a thing, but some crazy shit has happened since The Conjuring. Came anarchy to set the world afire, pain of hook and mouth in my darkest hour, corruption of the world, peace sells, nobody's buying, ignorant religion, holy wars, and the dying. Tornado nearly got me by the skin of my teeth, this was my life, foreclosure of my dreams. May the past rust in peace in Hangar 18, and countdown to extinction just be a bad dream. Lucretia used to say, what, no mechanics? And the refrain of the song reads, not even close, not even close, not even close to overdose. As if to say, we came, we saw, we conquered, and we're not going anywhere. Euthanasia feels more therapeutic than in any way innovative or particularly inspired as a record, and it kind of treads water on the dilemma of the old hippie. The album did very well regardless, peaking on the US Billboard charts at number 4, and would be certified platinum a year later in 1995, but the question still remained. Would Dave Mustaine and Megadeth hang on to the old, or should they grab on to the new? And in 1997, Megadeth would release what I believe is their final classic record, a brilliant synthesis of the thrash metal they introduced to the world with a little help from their frenemies, and the metal subgenre of grunge that had dominated rock radio airwaves for the better part of a decade. Cryptic Writings was another top 10 record for Megadeth. It was the band's final gold certification, and its first single would be the biggest in the band's history. The album opener, Trust. How does a thrash metal band from the 80s just leap into the new world of grunge without completely compromising the sound that brought them international success, critical acclaim, and a spot on the wall in the Heavy Metal Hall of Fame? It turns out the answer had been there all along in the form of a one-time opening act for Megadeth that had been blending metal and alternative rock since their inception in 1987. Cryptic Writings was Megadeth's seventh studio release, where it sounds to me like Dave Mustaine and his bandmates found a way forward in the dissonance and harmony of the heaviest of all grunge bands, Alice in Chains.
Hey, I know I made the same mistake, yeah. I won't do it again, no. Why are you slapping in the face now? I didn't say it was okay.
Warning to everybody out there who knows more about music and Megadeth and, like, the world than me. I'm going to go out on a limb here, but boy, howdy have I convinced myself of this one. Throughout Cryptic Writings, Megadeth includes the kind of vocal harmonies and chord progressions that sound uncannily similar to the soundscape that Alice in Chains had been producing in the decade leading up to 1997. Their MTV Unplugged record had been released the previous year, and their third studio album and final record to feature the late Lane Staley on vocals the year before that. Jar of Flies and Euthanasia had both been released in 1994, and Alice in Chains' magnum opus Dirt came out only a month after Countdown to Extinction in 1992. Previous to that, Mustaine and Megadeth had spent September of 1990 and July of 1991 hearing Alice in Chains' debut album, Facelift, played live nightly before they took the stage for the Clash of the Titans tour. However, unlike when I accused Metallica of ripping off Nirvana, Soundgarden, and Pearl Jam for Load in 1996, I don't think Megadeth was just grossly aping Alice in Chains on Cryptic Writings. It's a fine line between homage and theft, and I think Megadeth navigated it flawlessly. Listen to the second single off of Cryptic Writings, a song about heroin use, something both bands had very much in common. The song is called Use the Man, and pay particular attention when Mustaine intones the album title for the first and only time on a bridge that feels like Megadeth expertly synthesizing the strangely gorgeous harmonies one might expect from Alice in Chains. From there, the track accelerates towards its up-tempo conclusion, recalling the heavy metal and the Megadeth of the previous decade.
First one shot to say goodbye, when the last taste of morning cry. Just one shot to do him in. He hangs his head and wonders why. Why the morgue only lies. 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 But pain.
over the strings going into that heavy guitar tone. It's like Megadeth doing I Stay Away. I mean, come on. And yeah, it might be unconscious influence, but it's a fucking great one. If a heavy metal band wants to find a way into grunge, you would naturally want to listen to the grunge band that sounds the most metal. That's Alice in Chains. Cryptic Writings was the last Megadeth album I bought as a teenager, and of course I didn't hear the overlap then because I just wanted to have sex one time. But when I revisited the record for this episode and heard Use the Man again after more than a decade, I thought, hey, that's Alice in Chains. And then I couldn't unhear it because it's all over the record. Check this out. That is, in order, I'll Get Even, Sin, and Have Cool Will Travel. Again, I don't know if any of this was deliberate, but it sure sounds consistent to my ears, and the band was very much aware of the musical landscape surrounding the record. In an interview with Eon Music in 2019, Mustaine's right-hand man, Dave Ellefson, wow, really? Right-hand man? What the fuck, Quinn? Come on. Mustaine's bassist, Dave Ellefson, said of the album, "The 90s were not kind to thrash metal. Between the Seattle sound, the nu metal music, and all this stuff, I mean, for us thrash bands, it was challenging, and I think we really hit the mark with Cryptic Writings." Agreed. And Megadeth did incorporate a reimagining of their thrashier sound on a number of tracks for Cryptic Writings, including She-Wolf, FFF, and this absolutely blistering track, Disintegrators. Absolutely killer song. On Cryptic Writings, Megadeth reminded the world that grunge, despite its occasional sonic divergences, was still a subgenre of metal, and that even in 1997, no one was more metal than Megadeth. But time marches on, and even grunge wouldn't last forever. A popularized version of the sound that emerged from the Pacific Northwest in the early 90s would soon resurface, co-opting grunge as the vestigial hind limb on the bloated whale corpse beached on the shores of corporate radio known as alternative rock.
Closing time. Open all the doors and let you out into the world. Closing time. Turn all of the lights on over every boy and every girl. Closing time. One last call for alcohol, so finish your whiskey or beer. Closing time. You don't have to go home, but you can't stay here. I know who I want to take me home.
Oh yeah, it's time to shut that shit down. As the new millennium approached, heavy metal would give birth to the infrequently delightful and dangerously mutated offspring of nu metal.
This is why you always wear a condom when you're fucking with other genres.
Soon, rap rock crossovers and chin beards would begin popping up in the most unfortunate of places, including bands once beloved by the metal masses, and sadly, Megadeth would be no exception. In 1999, after the departure of Nick Menza on drums, Megadeth would release their eighth studio album and the final entry in our three-part and volume-for-all deep dive into the band, Risk. More on why I came to that decision in a moment. For now, let's dig into one of the top contenders for title of the worst Megadeth album to date. The title reportedly came from an offhand comment about Megadeth needing to take more risk with their music, made by Metallica's drummer Lars Ulrich, who isn't exactly known for the accuracy of his offhand. And the record feels about as well thought out as Lars's comment. It's a mixture of attempts at alternative rock on tracks like Breadline, Ecstasy, I'll Be There, and Wanderlust, which isn't a bad song, if you're Bon Jovi. And then there's some songs like Seven and Prince of Darkness, where for some reason Dave interpreted taking a risk to mean sounding exactly like Metallica on Low. Plus a mixed bag of leftovers like whatever Call the Doctor is, and then of course, the nu metal. Two songs compete for the closeted title of Soundtrack to a High School Weight Room on Risk, both the album opener Insomniomnia, which is a song about exactly what it sounds like, a track wherein Mustaine pleads with a listener, "Somebody turn out the lights, I can't sleep." Sounds like the solution is right there in the problem, Dave. And finally, the first single off of the record, Crush 'Em. Okay. Yeah, what to say here? What to say? Alright, yeah, Crush 'Em. Yes. Crush 'Em. Okay? Crush 'Em. What am I gonna say? Okay, Crush 'Em. Crush 'Em as a song, which it is so spectacularly bad, I had trouble finding ways to sufficiently convey its unprecedented levels of god-awful-itude here. But I'm still gonna try. So here we go. Crush 'Em is so bad that if writers for the popular 90s teen comedy Saved by the Bell were compelled to pen an episode in which a fictional heavy metal band performed their hit single for the students of Bayside High at everyone's favorite hangout, The Max, that song would be Crush 'Em. Crush 'Em is so bad that it would keep prolific American serial killer Ted Bundy up at night for fear that the song might be hiding under his bed. Crush 'Em is so inconceivably Crushem is so inconceivably bad that whatever... Fuck! Crushem is so inconceivably bad that whatever other virtues Risk may offer, its goodness isn't merely overshadowed by the superlative nature of Crushem's badness, but rather those unfortunate tracks that happen to fall into its proximal orbit are mindlessly and mercilessly dragged below the event horizon of the fourth track on Megadeth's eighth record, a place from which even light cannot hope to escape, where they are inevitably reduced to the fundamental components of what was once understood as matter, and finally unburdened from the illusory shackles of time and space, are summarily added as a string of unremarkable digits to the infinite density of the song's singularity, a concept functionally beyond reality that occupies what can only be described as an imaginary location in space no more substantial than that of a mathematical point, or so we would conceive of it if such a concept were in any way conceivable. And here it is. Crush 'em. Hey, that wasn't so bad.
Stupid idiot brain, I thought you had to do your Facebook.
Instagram!
Whatever, your Instagram. So, what do you do, man? Why are you here?
I missed you.
Alright, well, look,
Did you miss me?
Yeah, yes, I missed you too. But I gotta wrap up the episode here, so could you, like, you know, do anything else until I'm done?
Okay, I'm gonna go listen to Crushem.
Very good, stupid idiot brain. All right, I'll see you later.
I'm Audi 5000!
All right. Nobody says that anymore. For his part, Mustaine had no apologies for the record, telling Soundspike.com in 2001, "Like I said, I have no apologies for the record. It just should not have had the name Megadeth on it, because if anybody else's name was on Risk, it would have sold, I think, really well. But it didn't." Risk went to number 16 on the Billboard 200, but as of 2023, this year, it has failed to achieve even silver certification. In fact, Cryptic Writings was the last Megadeth record to earn any certification, and the band's capacity to sell records dropped off a cliff shortly thereafter. Despite there being some solid albums on the other side of the millennium, like United Abominations and Endgame, the praise for those records, both from fans and critics, is fairly easy to chart album to album based on how much any one record in particular recalls or echoes the sound of an earlier one. Metalheads are a famously loyal, if overly excitable, lot. As I'm recording this episode, Metallica is preparing to release their 10th album, 72 Seasons, and with each new advanced release, the metal community, or at least the emotionally rabid tip of the iceberg that engages on social media, lapses into convulsions of either outrage or elation. And sometimes, outlation. But we all know what's coming, don't we? The album will be somewhere between pretty good and dreadful, but no honest observer is going to put 72 Seasons within a fucking astronomical unit of the first four.
A man is out of
Okay, five.
Because I have responsibilities, I'm gonna do these freaking dishes.
Calm down, Deb. And the reason I'm not covering the albums after the new millennium is because this podcast is dedicated to the history, philosophy, and future of heavy metal. And I just don't think that anything after Risk is really gonna elucidate any of those topics in any meaningful way. I think it's fucking cool that people get excited for new Megadeth or new Metallica. I just don't. I don't feel like I need more from Megadeth or Metallica than they've already given me. I also know that neither band has been capable of that for at least 20 years, which is fine. It's the natural order of things. So get hyped for the new Metallica record, because it'll probably have some cool tracks or ones that remind you of their greatest albums. But I'm not going to pretend that 72 Seasons could actually be one of their truly great albums. Again, I don't need new Metallica. What I need is the next Metallica. We all do. But that doesn't have to stop us from getting excited to hear new music from a band that we love. So you should. Here's the other reason why I'm not covering the last 8 Megadeth records. Remember the first episode of this series? The one where I just impulsively did a Dave Mustaine impression even though I couldn't correctly pronounce his name and still kind of can't, and then I ended up with his voice trapped in my head and on my podcast for like 2 months? Yeah, that episode. On that episode, I made the point that Megadeth starts to lose me when the band becomes less important to Dave Mustaine than Dave Mustaine does. Cryptic Writings was the last album on which Nick Menza appeared. Risk was the last album for Marty Friedman. In 2001, Megadeth released The World Needs a Hero, and a year later, due officially to an arm injury, Mustaine dissolved the band and went into retirement. However, in a more recent interview, Mustaine said of his bandmates at the time, Al Petrelli, Jimmy DeGrasso, and co-founding member Dave Ellefson, "I hated being around those guys. So when the arm injury happened, it was a welcome relief." It was shortly after this that Mustaine got sober, the way a lot of people get sober, by transferring their addiction from a substance to something insubstantial. Instead of being hooked on drugs and alcohol, Dave got hooked on Jesus. And that is a good thing. Look, whatever it takes for an addict to get clean and stay clean, they should do it. But somewhere between disbanding and then rebanding Megadeth in 2004 and his conversion to Christianity, Dave really starts getting high on Dave. He remasters the entire Capitol Records catalog of Megadeth albums, making them decidedly worse. He pulls out of shows with bands he deems satanic and gets his own personal pastor to follow him around on tour. By the time we get to the 2010s, he's becoming more known for publicly promoting conspiracy theories about Barack Obama than for his music. It's one thing to have a political opinion as a public figure, but it's another to say that the President of the United States staged mass shootings at movie theaters and places of worship. He did kind of apologize for that, but on InfoWars, a show hosted by a guy who has admitted in court to lying about the massacre of children for profit. I mean, this is ugly stuff. It's kind of the ugliest stuff. It feels like he's backed away from the David Icke crowd in more recent years, and now he seems mostly interested in generating internet content by talking shit about Metallica. Which is my job, Dave. But the genesis of Mustaine's inward and downward spiral all starts in 1998. Megadeth was a musical project built on vengeance, which is cool when you're in your 20s. But by the time Megadeth is transitioning into the 90s with Euthanasia and Cryptic Writings, it's clear he doesn't need revenge anymore. You won, Dave. You made a metal band that is now more metal than Metallica and achieved mainstream success without compromising the things that made Megadeth great. But then one stray comment from a former bandmate and he jerks the wheel right back to where and who he was in 1985, completely changes his sound, alienates his entire band, and spends the rest of his career selling largely derivative albums to the same 10,000 people who bought the last one. And all because of a decade-old grievance against Metallica. Once again, Dave Mustaine finds himself in a ditch in Laramie, Wyoming, and the formula is always the same. Metallica's trying to hold him back. Obama is destroying the country. Black magic ruined his life. yes, he really said that. The problem is always something other than Dave Mustaine. There was a reason that he chose a victim as Megadeth's mascot. But what was once a symbol of vengeance for all of us has, over the decades, become a symbol of grievance for Mustaine and Mustaine alone. Now, I still have hope for Dave Mustaine. I can't help but root for the guy. I know, he's a millionaire and he doesn't need my help, but I have always had this feeling that he really is a better guy than the character he plays on the internet. Maybe I'm wrong, I don't know. He clearly feels things very deeply and overcompensates with the martial arts and the machismo because there are painful historical and personal wounds that just won't heal there. But there's a kind of light in his eyes these days when you see him talking about teaching guitar to young people, possibly his grandkids. It's incredibly endearing, and that's cool, and he should go do that. I'm sure that somewhere in his mind, it feels like a capitulation, but in the end, it's so much more meaningful than touring to support Hardwired to Self-Destruct. Somewhere in the United States, there could be a Greyhound bus still rolling around with an unfinished copy of Moby Dick tucked into the seat back pocket. My hope for Dave Mustaine is that someday he can find it, or it can find him, so that he can finally finish it. He can always come back to the Bible. I think it's still in print. Because if Dave Mustaine can finish the story of the great sea captain driven to madness and ruin by his obsessive quest for revenge, maybe it will allow him to finish his own story. And maybe he'll realize that vengeance was, at one time, useful. But if he looks at his life and his accomplishments, the history that he has written in the halls of heavy metal, he might see that he never needed vengeance to be great in the first place. Oh, okay, that's it. On the next, and volume for all. I don't know what I'm gonna do, but whatever it is, it'll probably be a little overdramatic, frequently tangential, and hopefully, occasionally, entertaining. But if you want to know what it's going to be about, there's only one time-tested way to achieve that knowledge. Fuck around and find out on the next and volume for all.